Blood releases carbon dioxide and picks up oxygen. Then the left side of the heart receives the oxygen-rich blood back from the lungs and pumps it out to the rest of the body. The familiar lup-dup sound of the heart is caused by valves closing. There are four chambers in the heart, two atria, which receive blood, and two ventricles, which pump blood out of the heart. In these chambers, there are four valves that regulate the flow of blood into and out of the heart. When the ventricles contract to pump, two valves close. This makes the first sound. When the ventricles relax, the other two valves close. This makes the second sound. Repeating its lup-dup cycle over and over, the heart pumps about 1,900 gallons a day at the rate of about 5 quarts a minute for 80 years or more. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared with help from Tony Mesher in the Medical Sciences Program. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
In sports this afternoon, the St. Louis Blues and Pittsburgh Penguins are swapping defensemen in a trade deadline deal. The deadline is 2 p.m. this afternoon, so we are now past that deadline. So the latest news, the Blues today sent 28-year-old Andy Wisniewski to Pittsburgh in exchange for 24-year-old Danny Richmond. Richmond has played in 55 games this season for Wilkes-Barre Scranton of the American Hockey League. He will report to Peoria, the Blues AHL team. Wisniewski appeared in one NHL game this season and has played in 77 over the past four seasons with 2 goals, 10 assists, and 81 penalty minutes. The Golden State Warriors will try to win back-to-back road games for the first time all season when they face the Chicago Bulls at the United Center tonight. The Bulls will be trying to improve on last night's dismal performance against Charlotte. Chicago shot 39% and committed 18 turnovers in a 96-80 loss that was their fourth in 6 games. In Big Ten action tonight, Northwestern is on the road to take on 19th-ranked Purdue. The Boilermakers have won 5 straight over Northwestern since the start of the 2006-2007 season. The Wildcats had won the previous 5. And Indiana lost its 8th straight game last night, falling to Michigan State 64-59. The Spartans wore down the shorthanded Hoosiers to clinch their first outright Big Ten title since 1999. Indiana finished 5-10 at Assembly Hall in Bloomington, the fewest home wins since going 5-6 in 1969-1970. That's sports. Each winter presents some homeowners with a choice, whether to replace old wooden windows with modern energy-efficient ones before cold winds blow again. Each year, more homeowners choose the replacement windows, often made from vinyl or aluminum. Sean Ali found some historical preservationists who want homeowners to think twice about that decision.
If you think century-old windows have to be rickety and leaky, Jack Spicer would like you to come to his place. He's eager to show off windows on his Chicago 2 flat, built in 1908.
So here's an example of the way an old-fashioned wood window looks from the outside 100 years later. These windows are longer lasting and obviously better looking than any replacement window you can find.
It's no surprise Spicer makes this pitch. See, he's with a group called Preservation Chicago, and he's on a campaign to save wood frame windows from the onslaught of vinyl and aluminum framed replacements. Spicer is losing ground, even in his own neighborhood.
This apartment building has replaced all their windows. The next house replaced all their windows. If you look across the street at this huge courtyard building, there are about 48 units in there, replaced their windows. Those windows were fine, and those windows are now trashed. They're in a dumpster and went into a landfill somewhere.
But if old wood-framed windows are so great, why do so many U.S. homeowners replace them?
Somebody told them that it would save them money if they put in brand-new replacement windows. But everybody's taught that. You read about it, you see the ads. All the replacement windows tell you that if you're a good American and you love your children, you will replace your windows. Well, we're getting over that now, I hope.
Spicer insists replacing your windows is not an environmental slam dunk. He says if old wood frame windows are properly sealed and have storm windows, they'll hold heat almost as well as replacements. I ask Spicer for numbers on this, and he sends me to Mike Jackson. Jackson's with the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency.
Several years ago, Vermont as a state, did a study, and they looked at repairing windows, adding storm windows, replacing windows, and what it really came down to was how leaky are your windows? If they were reasonably tight, there wasn't a lot of savings to replacing windows at all.
Jackson says a new furnace or insulation are better payoffs, and replacement windows often last just a few decades.
We're throwing away items that have lasted for 100 years with simple technologies, and we're replacing them with more complex things with shorter lifespans. In our line, the reason they call them replacement windows is because you have to keep replacing them.
Well, people in the replacement window industry don't take kindly to all this. One rep told me the short lifespan of replacement windows is overblown. High-quality ones last longer. And he told me if energy prices rise in the future, replacement windows become more competitive. So is it worth replacing old wooden windows?
There's many factors, and that's why it's, in our opinion, not so clear-cut.
Christian Kohler studies window technology at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He says replacement windows are better on energy, but it could take decades to get a good payback. And by that time, you might need to replace them again. Anyway, Kohler says there's an alternative. If your wood windows are in good condition, you can add storm windows. They have what's called a low E coating. The coating helps retain heat.
It's applied to glass and it's virtually invisible. It doesn't have a color or anything.
Kohler says if preservationists want to keep wood windows around on account of their looks or long-term value, they should still crack down on leaks and get good storm windows. After all, it doesn't make sense to waste energy on account of beauty when you don't have to. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer and poet Elizabeth Spires found inspiration for her new collection of poems in the stone carvings of African-American sculptor William Edmondson. The unschooled son of slaves, he began sculpting at the age of 57 in Nashville, Tennessee. He said his work was divinely inspired. He spent some time working under Franklin Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration. He was the first African-American artist to have a solo show at the Museum of Modern Art. The year was 1937. Elizabeth Spires' collection of poems, I Heard God Talking to Me, William Edmondson, and His Stone Carvings, also contains stunning black and white photos of Edmondson and his limestone carvings. Elizabeth Spires is my guest in this portion of the program. Good to talk with you. What a beautiful book.
Oh, thank you, Celeste.
What was your introduction to the life and sculpture of William Edmondson?
Well, I go to Nashville fairly frequently because my husband is from Nashville, and that's where Edmondson, you know, was born, lived, worked, died. There's quite a few of his pieces there, so I got to know his work, first of all in Nashville and then later in other places.
Yeah, and when did you come across the photographs that were made of him?
Well, as I got more interested, I wanted to read a couple books about him, and some of these archival photographs, you know, there was mention or reproduction of photos by Edward Weston and Louise Dahl Wolfe, and they really, Edmondson's work is very alive, but those photos of the sculptor himself really are just so amazing.
Yeah, tell us, describe for us the photograph that's on the jacket of the book.
It's a beautiful, you know, very deep, rich photo. It hardly looks like it's black and white in the way it's got so many tones. And Edmondson is kind of looking up. He's in his work clothes. And right behind him is a sculpture of his called Miss Louisa. It's a little limestone lady holding a hat.
I think that's one of my favorites, Miss Louisa. One of the first photos in the book is of his yard full of sculptures, and there's a great deal of variety in them. And in one of your poems, you write about that. The poem is Adam and Eve, and the second stanza includes these lines. Everything grows as it pleases, and no one is banished for eating an apple from an apple tree. What kind of pleasure have you taken in writing these poems?
It's been one of the, really most enjoyable projects I've ever done. I mean, writing poetry is fun, but it's a lot of work, too. And these pieces spoke to me. I guess you could say William Edmondson heard God talking to him, and his pieces spoke to me to such a degree that I felt that I had to give them voice.
Yeah. He said his work was divinely inspired. Did he speak of how he came to be called to the work?
Well, since he had been a boy, he had experienced visions. And the first poem in the book, which is actually a couple of these poems, I've actually used his words. And he said, "I had a vision. I was just a boy, about 13, 14 years old, doing in the cornfields. I saw in the East world. I saw in the West world. I saw the flood." And the picture that accompanies the poem, that's the first stanza, is Edmondson leaning against Noah's Ark that he carved.
Yeah.
And then the poem goes on, "I ain't never read no books nor no Bible, and I saw the water come. It come over the rocks. It covered up the rocks and went over the mountains. God, he just showed me how."
Mm. And then the second poem takes off from there. It's called The Gift.
Mm-hmm.
You want to share that with us?
Sure. And Edmondson is, all these poems are on, faced with one of these beautiful photos. "One night, God talked so loud he woke me up. He told me he had something for me. Later, I was out in the driveway with some old pieces of stone when I heard a voice telling me to pick up my tools and start to work on a tombstone. I looked up in the sky, and right there in the noon daylight, he hung a tombstone out for me to make. I knowed it was God telling me what to do. First he told me to make those tombstones, then he told me to cut the figures. He gave me them two things."
How did he come to the attention of the Museum of Modern Art?
That's part of the wonder of this whole story. He was just quietly working away in his yard for 6 or 7 years. As he would finish these limestone carvings, they would go out in the yard, which was kind of overgrown. And a professor in Nashville who lived nearby would take his daily walk, and he got very interested in Edmondson's yard and struck up an acquaintance. He ended up introducing Edmondson to Louise Dahl Wolf, a photographer from New York who was down visiting in Nashville. She took 100 pictures of Edmondson, actually over 100, and showed them, went back up to New York and showed them to Alfred Barr, the director of the Museum of Modern Art then. And they decided to give him a show. So he went from total obscurity to a show at the Museum of Modern Art.
And as I mentioned, the year was 1937. What happened to him from that point on?
Well, he didn't go to this show. I find that to be both kind of in character, but you can't imagine now somebody not going to their show at the Museum of Modern Art. He stayed in Nashville working away, and also another thing that's very odd about this is his prices really didn't change. He was selling these carvings, they're about a knee high, some of them, for $5 or $10 or $15 out of his yard. He called them yard ornaments.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kept working until around 1948. He couldn't work anymore for health reasons. He had to stop. But he didn't become some sort of huge celebrity in Nashville. He just quietly kept working.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Miss Louisa as one of my favorite sculptures and one of my favorite poems. What do you have a favorite?
Well, I have a favorite sculpture. There's one he has. He liked to carve both realistic, people that actually existed and imaginary beings. So he has one called Angel with a Pocketbook, and I just love the pairing of this winged angel standing there very solidly, 2 feet on the ground, holding a pocketbook.
Yeah. And did you write a poem about that angel?
I did.
And can you give us a sense of it?
Do you want me to describe it, or would you like me to read it?
Give us a little sense of it and then read it.
Okay. I considered anybody who would envision an angel holding a pocketbook that it's an unusual angel, so
yeah.
We're not going to get angelic thoughts. the poem begins, the angel's talking. I never thought I'd get to heaven, but I did. I closed my eyes and died, then flew straight up through clouds that looked like cotton candy, clutching my pocketbook. The angel at the gate said, I wouldn't need a pocketbook in heaven, but I held on tight and said I would. We argued for a while, and then he let me in, which proves that stubbornness must be a virtue, at least sometimes.
Mm. That's the kind of angel I'd like to have looking over my shoulder. So we've got to wrap up here. Is this artist that inspired your poetry, does he kind of come and go in our in the art world? Does he come and go, or I mean, is he now undergoing a renaissance?
Well, he's a well-known figure in the folk art world, not in terms of it. He's new to a lot of people that you would say are part of a general audience. But he does have pieces in major museums, the American Museum of Folk Art in New York City, the Philadelphia Museum, the Hirshhorn have pieces, the Smithsonian. And, folk art collectors, he's expensive to, you know, acquire. I mean, I'm not ever going to be able to have a William Edmondson. But I hope this book is going to, though, you know, make him better known to people outside that folk art world.
Yeah. Well, again, it's a beautiful book. Elizabeth, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Elizabeth Spires. She's a writer and poet, and she found inspiration for her new collection of poems in the stone carvings of African-American sculptor William Edmondson. The book, I Heard God Talking to Me, William Edmondson and His Stone Carvings, is a Francis Foster book. That is a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Earth and Sky.
Rosalind Byrne of the University of Virginia studies the ethics of nanotechnology. That's the manipulation of atoms to create new materials. She spoke with us about nanotechnology as applied to agriculture.
For example, I learned about a product that can be sprayed onto plants that, in effect, accelerate the photosynthesis process. Now, that sounds like something that we should not hesitate to do because it means we'll get plants growing faster, bigger, more robust.
But Byrne said there's more to consider.
But what we don't understand is what happens to that product if and when it washes into the soil, goes downstream, is absorbed by other species.
Byrne said ecosystems are complex, and she urges caution.
What we do may have effects that we cannot in